Hi, this is Paul Siegel. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on today's episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about bringing old school sensibilities into 5th edition style games. And for this discussion, we have our very special guest, Joe Manganiello, who is an actor and director and producer and I'd say D&D ambassador these days, and also Stephen McCauley, who is an educator and a live streamer and runs a number of different D&D groups, including the East Coast Slayers campaign group. So Joe and Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. When did you guys, so you guys grew up together, is that right?
Yep, that's right.
And now, like outside Pittsburgh, did I see that right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, back in the day, nobody really lived in downtown Pittsburgh, so it's okay. All just a series of suburbs. But yeah, we grew up in the suburbs south of Pittsburgh in a town called Mount Lebanon. We both went to St. Bernard's Elementary School, not St. Bernard's. Pittsburgh's kind of famous for mangling the pronunciation of words. Like, you know, the palace that Napoleon lived in is Versailles. North Versailles. The first president of the United States was George Washington. And we went to St. Bernard's.
Elementary.
That's funny. I went to college in New London, which is on the Thames, not the Thames.
Yeah, not the Thames.
Yeah.
And Joe and I were born same year, 76, but I'm January and he's December, so we were not in the same grade. I was a year above him, much wiser, much more astute in the ways of schooling.
But piggybacking on that, I got into tabletop gaming. And I taught Steve. I brought Steve in to play tabletop gaming. Steve was one of my first guinea pigs in Pittsburgh. I started playing. I spent every summer growing up on this island off the coast of Portland, Maine, called Peaks Island in Casco Bay. And there were kids on that island that were in the comic books the way that I was, fantasy novels, Stephen King books. And at the time, I mean, we're talking, must have been 84, 85, maybe 1985. In New England, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle black and white comic had just come out, yeah. And that was like spread like a wildfire through kids in New England. And because I was there during this one particular summer when the comics started dropping, I had that in common with those kids, and they got me into it. And at the time, there was you know, the Ninja Turtles role-playing game through Palladium.
Yep.
And so I started running those games. I started running, we were playing Marvel Superheroes TSR.
Yeah.
And prior to that, I guess I should back up a little bit. I had a Red Box. I made my mother buy me the Larry Elmore cover Red Box. Yep. I didn't know what was in it as a kid. I just saw that Larry Elmore painting and thought, I need this. And I thought it was like a novel inside, but they were these instruction manuals that I didn't understand at the time. So it kind of sat on the shelf because I was too young. I was like 7, 8 years old. I didn't know what to do with it. But that summer with those kids and the Ninja Turtle comics and then the role-playing game, that's where I started cracking the code and figuring out how to play tabletop. So when I came back to Pittsburgh, I put together a group, and Steve was the first member of that group.
Dave Brown. It
was an exciting time because, so I grew up in Maine myself, actually, and I think the guys that made Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I think they were in like Portsmouth, New Hampshire or something like that originally. And so I was in junior high school when that black and white comic first came out, and one of my friends brought number one in, and he like somehow he knew the guys that had done it, and I was like, very interesting, very, very cool and very interesting. And, you know, I played a lot of, like, I played a lot of the Marvel Superheroes set myself, like, right here next to me.
Speaking of next to me, this isn't Ninja Turtles number one, but this is the oversized Raphael number one.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Casey Jones. This is
the oversized. See that red, black, and white ink? That was the old original cover.
I'll give you a fun
piece of trivia for anyone who's played the Palladium Ninja Turtles game, which we can get into in a second. But yeah, Eastman and Laird, the guys who created it, they were from the New England area, so they were the first comic book stores to get those issues. But a few years ago, I wound up acquiring the original watercolor painting that was the cover of the original Palladium Ninja Turtles role-playing game. Like, I have the Kevin Eastman cover, you know, watercolor painting that became that cover hanging on my wall right over there.
I have seen it in person, and that cover is just one of the sickest covers. TMNT and Other Strangenesses, and it's just, magical.
I feel like Palladium always had, like, that plus they just had really great covers. Like, I have a couple, you know, fantasy books from Palladium, and the thing that always sucked me into it is the really amazing covers for that and Rifts and stuff like that.
That was Kevin Long.
Yeah.
So speaking of Kevin Long, I just recently bought the painting that was the cover for Transdimensional TMNT.
Awesome.
That rift down the middle and half Rex and half robot. I have that. It's going to go to the framers.
Of course, he texts me that, and I'm like, oh my God. Okay. sounds lovely.
So you guys have me a little disadvantaged because I've never played any of the Palladium stuff. So somebody, anyone, pitch me on, like, what was great about Palladium back in the day?
Well, I'll tell you what was great about Palladium. Yeah. Joe was great about Palladium. That's you see him now, and you hear the streams and his passion for it. And what you need to understand is that passion was there 30 years ago.
Yeah,
he had me sucked in, and the very first adventure, TMNT was strictly mutants, so running off the Palladium system, but you would mutate animals, and they had all sorts of different mutants. And as the future books came out, more options for mutants. I chose to become a Wolverine. Tons of fun. But what it really was this kid who was a year younger than me and a grade younger than me sold me. I mean, I was already Star Wars. I was already comics. But I'm here watching my friends spin these tails with an intensity. I mean, palms sweaty, like vomit on my sweater, mom spaghetti sort of level in grade seven. And I could not believe how intense it was. And here you've got Nintendo that had just come out. And I mean, everybody wants to play video games and is loving it. Yet somehow I would forgo all of that to sit down at his mom's place in the back alcove area and just listen to him spin these tales, man. And my first experience with a dice outside of a six-sided, you're sitting there and you're like, wow, there's other side of dice. And
I think that you're kind of keying in on, I think, one of the core sort of old school tenets, right, of this idea of it being, you know, rulings, not rules, of, you know, the system. Something I've said a lot on my blog is, like, the best system is the one that the GM is passionate about, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, and to answer your question about, thank you, Steve, and thank you. But to answer your question about what was different about the Palladium system, you know, Palladium was a D10 system in that you had skills, and you were rolling the D10s against your skills. You know, you'd have a certain percentage out of 100 to drive a car under, you know, duress, or pilot an airplane, or fix something, or, you know, read some sort of navigational equipment. You rolled the dice to see if you could do that. But with that said, combat was a D20 system, but I found that TMN, the way the Palladium games work was, there the leveling up didn't mean as much.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, all you got was small, tiny percentages for your skills, and that was it. So what I did was, what was really fun, I think, about the Palladium games were, was the character creation more than anything else was really fun. What are you going to play? Pick that thing. And when it came to Rift, it was incredibly imbalanced.
Yeah.
You know, you've got one character who's a, you know, a vagabond scholar with his bag of books, and someone else has this giant mech power armor.
Yep. Glitter so boy.
Unbalanced. So what I did in terms of the TMNT game was, you know, you rolled on a table to figure out what animal or dinosaur or whatever you were, or, you know, sometimes I'd let people pick, or I'd make them roll and they'd pick out of like three. So you pick your animal, you mutate your animal, create your character, and then I incorporated their book, Ninjas and Super Spies. So Ninjas and Super Spies was this other, you know, world book in which every single martial art in the history of the world was documented and broken down, and that actually did level up. From level to level, you would unlock different powers from Muay Thai kickboxing or ninjutsu or sumo or, you know, Wing Chun.
Jade and so, fan, baby.
So I took those, I just combined them. So everybody was an animal, and then you also had this martial art, and that became what the leveling system was to keep it interesting. You know, keep people engaged.
Which is the module that I followed too. At first, becoming a DM, Joe really taught me almost everything. When I just started out, I was almost copying verbatim what he was doing. I didn't have a basis, and he had all these creative ideas, and I needed some starting point. I mean, we've all been there as a beginner DM where you're in over your head and you don't know what to do, so you kind of rely on something that
And I'd say with Palladium, like, there's a lot of content there, right? So that most of that stuff's written by Kevin Sambita. And he was enormously prolific. He'd write lots and lots of dense content, probably not play tested a whole lot. So it kind of really warrants the DM taking more of a strong hand at the wheel of making what they want out of it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, because, I mean, we're here to talk about, you know, converting to 5e versus old school, you know, like D&D gaming. I think this is important to give the backstory because there was a ton of content and these amazing science fiction ideas. I think Kevin and company had these incredible stories. They were really good at story arc and character in a way that, you know, I don't think you can think of, you know, other than the novelizations, D&D characters aren't that famous per se. But what happened with Kevin and his licensing of Ninja Turtles, he had famous characters. So there were famous characters running around in this world, and I think that lent to these amazing stories. So for me, as a young game master, dungeon master, that helped me because there was only the story idea on the bone. I had to build the rest of it out, and I think that serves me now as a 5e Dungeons and Dragons dungeon master, because I'm used to telling my own stories. I'm used to creating my own characters. I'm used to embedding them in the story and building them as time goes along, where I don't necessarily think the modules of D&D teach you how to do that. The modules in D&D are perfectly balanced, you know, especially those old school dungeons. You know, they're like, it's like science, you know, it's like looking at a genius, like some beautiful ice crystal, you know, that someone created in a lab, where the whole Palladium adventures were more of, it was an idea and a storyline for, it was like a pitch or an outline for a season of TV where D&D gives you the scripts.
You know, I know the Fear of a Black Dragon guys, in trying to define what is old school, they do a lot of module reviews, so they dig up old modules and review them, and one of the things they came to ultimately is, like, what defines old school is generally the modules have a beginning, maybe some middle, but no end, right? They are, like, the ending is not prescripted in any kind of, like, old school writing, right? It's the GM has to figure that out.
Interesting.
I absolutely agree with what Joe said. That background in Palladium has given me the ability to write and be creative in D&D 5e. It's, again, that's not something that's going to be learned overnight. You need experience. You need to fail a ton of times in adventures that are just slogging through to get to where you need to be, where the intensity really shows forth.
Well, I like the D&D modules, but for me, I wear them like a loose garment.
Yeah. Okay.
For me, this is an outline. You know, I'm running Tyranny of Dragons right now, which they just re-released in this beautiful, you know, hardcover where they combine both books. What's the differences between old school and new school? I mean, I've thought a lot about that.
Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Because I think it seems like there's, you know, like everything, people are trying to create a chasm and stick a wedge and create different groups, you know, so there's these different ideologies between the two. But I think, you know, when we were younger, it was, you know, I see online now, like, you know, like safe words for playing D&D, like checking in with your players, making sure that everyone's all right with what's going on. And, I mean, we didn't have that when we were younger, you know?
No, we did not.
He wanted to kill you. He wanted to kill you. If he was doing your job, he was trying to murder you. And you were scared for your life. That was how it was for us. We liked it.
Joe, I was telling Paul before you came on about the Hand of Vecna and how people were shocked. And I'm sitting there going, for real? Joe and I were two of the most conniving players, man. It was all about business at hand. You took what you needed to do. I would give you the shirt off my back in real life. But in game, dude, you cross me, you're done, man. You're done, and it may take a year to get you, but I will get you.
But you stole that. You backstabbed that group. I mean, you know, they say that about... Steve is talking about the critical role appearance that I made. And it's like, I didn't backstab anybody. You know, I'm playing a high level, at the time, 17th level paladin. You know, when you're playing a religious character or a holy character whose power is derived from a god, at that level, it's about the end game.
Yeah.
So it's about... You know, what's the ultimate goal of that character? And as a Tiamat worshiper, the ultimate goal is to free her. That's what every Tiamat worshiper, every, you know, Dragon Army member wants. So if, you know, I'm in an adventure where the boss, this in this case Vecna, had the ability to teleport cities from the Shadowfell and armies from the Shadowfell, he's teleporting these big land and groups of people, you have to think, Whatever he's using to do that would be exactly what my character would need to free Tiamat. So, you know, I was just following my character's arc. Really, absolutely. It just so happened that there was a group that could help me achieve that. But I needed to figure out how to get out of there. And, you know, the most dramatic way to get out of there and the most sensible way to get out of there was to chop off my own arm and replace it with
it. that's truly amazing. I agree that that's a very old school trope, right? If you look at how the players with Gygax or Arneson played, there was a lot of player versus player competition, actually. And it's kind of interesting that you might come in and possibly surprise current players with that same kind of move, which is like a fascinating, dramatic thing to happen.
Well, it only works if you're there for, you know, two adventures. You know, I was there for two sessions. Yeah. If I was there for the entirety of a season, you have to play nice. Yeah. But I think that also fits into the doctrine of the character, which is, you know, alone, what he can achieve in a group would be greater than what he could achieve alone. So even though you're playing an evil-aligned character, he could play nice with other characters because they're helping him to achieve his goal that he would never be able to achieve otherwise. It's just once you get down to the wire and the end of the campaign, you're going to see somebody's true colors, and it was just the right time.
Absolutely.
Paul and I actually did a similar thing at a convention last year. We were running a predecessor of Tomb of Horrors, and I had Paul as a player plant, right? And so he actually switched sides halfway through the session. He was actually the arch lich in disguise. And one of our favorite things.
Nice.
One of our favorite things is that the other players were trash talking the Lich the whole game, right? And said to Paul at one point, turned to Paul and said, "Boy, I really hope the Lich can't hear all this." And of course, Paul was the Lich.
It was a wonderful moment. It was a wonderful moment. So when I got to turn to that player and said, "You die first."
Yes.
I mean, I think the trick to that kind of play, right, is to be able to do it with a smile on your face and a glint in your eye, so that like we as players collectively know we're all having fun together, even like I'm out to get you, right?
As a DM, I'm constantly sowing the seeds of discord amongst my players. I am always just trying to undermine their values and get them to not trust each other, just constantly causing problems. Now that can get explosive too, because Joe can attest to this. I'm a fiery person. My players are fiery people. I mean, there are nights where people are standing. It gets a little intense.
Well, you know, somebody asked me recently. They said, you know, what are you? I think it was I was in Luca at the Luca Festival. So actually, I work as the official ambassador for Dungeons and Dragons now. I which is kind of mind blowing as we're talking about
trying to
look at, you know, my best friend from growing up in elementary school, who I used to game with. You know, but over there, someone asked me in an interview, you know, what kind of a DM are you? You know, and you know, that's a very long-winded, you know, answer, because there's the mythology aspect, the storytelling part, you know, the character development part, you know, the prep. I do these huge builds with Dwarven Forge, and, you know, I have, you know, custom mini painters that make me creatures that I can then create the stats for. I also do voices. I'm an actor, so all my characters have voices, and, you know, the bartender and the monk, and, you know, but what I said in a very cheeky way, because I was trying to get at and trying to break up some of these very precious modern feelings about role playing, was I just try to kill my players. I think if they're not afraid of me, then I'm not doing my job. And, you know, I was being cheeky about it, but you know, at the end of the day, you know, understanding the rules and mastering the rules in terms of your monster's stat blocks is super important. You know, the monsters and NPCs are my characters. And so if, you know, I study those stat blocks, because if I'm playing an adult black dragon, for example, and I'm not thinking about, you know, how that dragon would go about strategically trying to kill a threat, if I'm not thinking along those lines, I don't think I'm really doing my job, because my players could walk away and say, "Wow, yeah, we killed that dragon, but didn't that seem easy? Or maybe he didn't do it right." Or, you know, I want them to have the full experience, and what that takes is thinking like your monsters, which in essence boiled down is I'm trying to kill him.
It's a
absolutely.
It's a lot, right? There's a lot to GMing to have to juggle that, and also you're the impartial referee who's adjudicating the rules, you know, and your, you know, role playing allies. Like, there's a lot of stuff for the GM to be juggling there.
There is.
You know, Dan and I have experimented a bunch. He gave one example, but experimented a bunch with two DMs at the table. Our favorite way of doing that, honestly, is to have one person be the impartial referee and one person just be the antagonistic, I'm controlling the bad guys and I'm trying to kill you. And it's super fun. Right. If you ever get a chance to do it, I definitely recommend it.
I have thought about that concept, too. You almost need a rules manager versus just the diabolical fiend DM.
It's funny. It can take the players a little by surprise, because we did it once, and one of the players I remember was casting a magic missile and trying to decide how many missiles to send at Dan's high priest. And he's like, "Oh, maybe one is enough, or maybe I should send all of them at him." And Dan was like, "Oh, one is definitely enough. That'll kill me." And I had to lean over to the guy and saying, "He doesn't want you to win. Don't listen to him. He's trying to win."
But, you know, the flip side of that is also, like, you know, I ran a game on Friday for my home group, and I created these, like, half, they're basically wingless, giant-sized dragons.
Okay.
Okay, so it's like basically there were stone giants that, through the powers of Tiamat's magic and her death priest, Krull, he had transformed these. They're capturing stone giants and turning them into these, you know, stone giants, hill giants, into these monstrosities. And I kept recharging my breath weapons every single roll. So I had two of them on the table.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they just kept recharging. Oh, and nice. You know, there's that. But in the pit of my stomach, I'm thinking, they're all going to die. Like, yeah. Because, yeah. You know, I had a blue and a red, and they kept lining for the blue, and everyone was getting hit by that lightning bolt. And then, you know, the red would move around and I would recharge the fire cloud, the fire cone. And it was right. Like, they're all going to die. And right. So I'm in my brain. My brain is starting to lay the track of like, just be ready in case only one of them gets out.
Yep. Right.
So I will do this. I'll do the same. Like, I'm trying to kill you, but I'll confess. I mean, out of game, I'll confess that's an act. Right. And yeah, secretly, sure. Like I fought, you know, I become a fan of my players' characters. And so like I have to do a whole lot of stuff where I really try to lock down the rules and, you know, roll the dice in the open specifically because I actually don't trust myself not to cheat in favor of the players secretly.
That's an interesting concept.
Yeah. So I actually kind of handcuff myself and kind of really put everything out on the table specifically because I don't want to cheat in their favor.
Right.
As I would actually.
No, I know. It's an interesting thing. I mean, but that's why, you know, if you look at like the old school writing, the DM was considered a referee by Gary and
So somebody we actually just got so usually when we co-DM, Paul's the impartial ref and I'm the adversary, and we actually Paul just got a referee shirt. So our next convention, he's actually wearing a referee shirt.
Yeah. Whistle and everything. Yep.
Hilarious. Well, we'll have to make a Death Saves referee jersey or something.
Death Saves referee jersey.
That's great.
We were actually discussing that. I would buy that. That would be nice. Yeah.
Probably would too.
So I'm a big system. So as a big systems guy, and you guys grew up playing Palladium, when did you guys make the switch to actual D&D?
Well, I'll let Joe definitely start the answer because he sent me a Christmas gift that definitely changed my life a couple years back.
So I started with that red box, but didn't know how to use it. And so it kind of sat on my shelf, and I may have tried out the solo adventure. I think, you know, as a kid, I figured out how you create that world, that fighter character, and then you fight through that adventure, and I think I made my own elf character when that was a class and a race together, you know, in the basic set. But I got swept up in all those Palladium games, and but there were kids in, I guess it was high school, who were playing. They were playing 2E Dragonlance.
I was
obsessed with all those novels, and of course the artwork of Larry Elmore and Margaret and Tracy. So I read the Dragonlance. I had a Minotaur for 2E, Dragonlance, and I played that. And then side note, I also played Warhammer Fantasy.
Yeah, nice.
Which was kind of the predecessor for like Zweihänder now is like kind of taking the torch of old school Warhammer. So I played that as well, and there were a few groups that played that. But, you know, I took a break. There was a break that happened where it was like, oh, well, you know, whatever it was. Girls happened. You got to go get a real job. You got to go to college, you know. And then I played three sports a year. So, you know, it was busy. Other than the summertime, I really never got to play. I had to put it down. And I just let go of it. I went to drama school. I went to L.A., started working as an actor. And I was doing Streetcar Named Desire at Yale for Yale Repertory Theater, which is in Connecticut, where Steve was living and teaching.
Stanley.
Hey.
And so I called him up and said, hey man, I'm doing Streetcar at Yale. You know, you gotta bring the wife, I'll get you tickets. You know, he's like, yeah, forget about that. He's like, we started playing, which is so one of like the bigger jobs of my life. And he's like, listen. You know, we started playing Palladium again. You got to make a character and come. We're all married with kids and teachers, and you know, you got to come play. And so, you know, one Friday, the last Friday of rehearsals, I, you know, rented a car, made a character, and drove, you know, halfway across the state and went and played again. And I got hooked. And so that's what got me back into tabletop after that long, like 20-year hiatus. But then what happened was I wound up getting involved with Dungeons & Dragons when the rights were at Warner Brothers. I had done a few movies in the system, and I knew that they had it. And I was really interested. I'm still very, you know, very much interested in making turning Dragonlance into, you know, something on the screen.
That
and through that, 5E had just come out.
Okay.
And I fell in with a Warner's executive, a bunch of comedians who were playing 5E. And so I started relearning the rules through 5E right when it came out, and then started flying back and forth to Seattle to work with Wizards. And then I became a consultant, a writer, and an ambassador for D&D. And then I, you know, sent Steve this big Christmas package and was like, listen, I know you guys are like heavily embedded in Palladium, but you've got to come over to the dark side. You don't know what this brand is going to blow up. Like, it's going to get crazy with D&D. There's something magic going on with this new rules change. And then I'll let Steve take over.
Yeah. And I was reticent. You sent them to me. The artwork was amazing. Loved it. Certainly knew some back things, had played new dungeon board game. So, and I had the red box as well. So I'm seeing in the monster manual, black puddings and mind flares. I'm like, ooh, this is cool. And Joe and I are both pretty ferocious readers. And I know Joe just consumes this stuff. I mean, he's got the rules down. He's probably, of anyone I've played with, the most technical player I've seen. And he's amazing at his just uncanny ability of really having the rules down. And I was always more the storyteller that kind of had guys on the side who would help me with the rules. And it took me a while. It took me 6 months. Those books sat there. And I'd look at them occasionally, and I'd read them, and I'm like, oh, dad, I got to learn another system. I'm just, you know, I'm embroiled in this system right now. I'm running a killer campaign. And then it hit me. I sat there. I visited our friend Jeff Maliska, who had moved recently to Asheville, North Carolina, and I said, you know, my man, I'm ready for a switch. So I brought the books down. We looked through them. We scoured them. We watched YouTube videos on how to try to make characters and trying to understand this new way of gaming. We were just total failures at it for a while. And then I decided to bring players in, some older guys, some newer guys. And through time, I mean, it got better. I mean, our first adventure, which I streamed on our page, the East Coast Slayer Facebook page, was terrible. I had no idea what I was doing. I was DMing, and I was completely out of my comfort zone. But that's how we start.
Yeah.
And through just incredible reading and incredible going back, and after every adventure, sitting there and going, okay, what did I miss there? Oh, I missed concentration on this. Oh, it should have been an opportunity attack on this. Oh, I did that wrong. You get yourself better.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to dedicate yourself. There's no question of that.
I sympathize, Steve, with it being, you know, a hard lift to switch to a new system when you've been DMing for a long time with something. So I tend to be like I tend to be the most grippy with like older school stuff. Paul has moved to 5th edition, you know, faster than I have. So apparently you were ahead of me seeing this like take off in the last couple of years. For a long time, I had a chart on my wall here of like people getting into D&D, and it was going down, down, down over time. And then all of a sudden something happened in the last decade. And I'm like, I did not see that happening. Are you guys surprised by D&D becoming like publicly acceptable and popular all of a sudden? Because for guys of our age, right, like some of us had to keep it secret as like this thing that was like, right. I mean, there was a satanic panic, but in the 80s, sure. But even more than that, it was just like, oh, you'd get bullied for it at one point. Are you surprised that all of a sudden?
I'm like, just going to say that my colleagues at work, work at Wolf Pit Elementary School in Norwalk, for about the first 4 years that we were doing this, gaming night consisted of me telling them that I was playing video games on like a PS4.
There you go. So,
yeah. Well, I don't want to be too grandiose. I'd like to think that I had something to do with that. And what I mean is, you know, I remember being in my kitchen with, you know, one of the, you know, Wizards of the Coast, you know, employees, you know, one of the very high up, one of the, you know, the creative brand directors. And I said, in a year's time, I'm going to make sure that no one ever makes fun of anyone who plays Dungeons and Dragons again.
That's amazing.
Beast.
And it kind of happened. Beast. I mean, I wound up on Stephen Colbert, rolling dice, talking insider baseball about D&D for like the first segment on a major talk show. That had never happened before.
I could not believe, Joe, I saw that and I could not believe what I was seeing. Like I never in my life, I never thought that was gonna happen on network television.
So there was, you know, it was that, you know, I live here in LA and in Hollywood, and I work with, you know, prolific actors, directors, writers. I know them all. They're my friends. And I know that they all grew up rock stars, wrestlers. They all grew up playing D&D. I know that. So it became less daunting when I would say, do you want to come over and play at my house? Well, I haven't played in forever. Don't worry about it. Come on. And, you know, you look at my Instagram page and it's like the likes of, you know, Dan and Dave from Game of Thrones, James Gunn, whether it's Brad Peyton or The Big Show or Tom Morello or Vince Vaughn or, you know, anybody, they come over, they play at my spot. And I think what happens is, I think a couple of things happened. One thing was, you know, the 5e rules were simplified. They came back down off, you know, 3, 3.5, 3.75, 4. They all got very complex and insider.
Yeah.
And I think that coupled with the satanic panic during the 80s, like you mentioned, which is like kids are getting beat up over it. Churches are burning books. You know, kids getting pushed into the basement, if you call it, you know, and having a lie about what they were doing. I think that type of public sentiment, that stigma just attached itself. So, you know, I was at a point in my career where I just thought, what the hell is anybody going to say to me at this point? You know what I mean? It's like, what are you going to say? Oh, if you play D&D, you're going to wind up like him? Like, I don't know, you know? Like,
I had some choice words for you when the package arrived of all the new books that I had to read in, like, no time. I'm like, damn it.
Well, but I mean, as far as public sentiment goes, it's like, what are you going to say? You're going to say it's, I mean, whatever. So I started speaking about it publicly. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, now people talk to me. People stop me on the street when I'm in foreign countries. I was in Paris at a, you know, a fashion, you know, high fashion store, and someone's like, says something about Archon the Cruel, to you know, middle of France, and, you know. So it's like it became okay to talk about it, and also like the mainstream. I mean, I'm not talking about like an insular community. I'm talking about like the actual mainstream. People know about it, and they know that I play, and they ask me about it. And I think there's a curiosity that's been piqued, and the rules in 5e are now easy enough that anybody can pick it up and try. You just need, like Steve was saying, you need somebody who's got the, you know, the guts to DM and just pick the book up and stay a chapter ahead of their group, or learn as you go along, and who's not afraid to fail that way. So that's why it's like, you know, I think you talk about old school, new school. The old school, okay, yes, we had shame. We would shame each other. And I know the younger generation is trying to eradicate that. You know, but with it, I think, has come this fear of trying. When we were younger, we didn't care. We just did it, you know? We just DM'd. And even if you fumbled through it or you made a mistake, you learned how to do it. And that's the beauty of D&D. It's like, I hear people say things about gatekeepers, and, okay, people will come after me for saying this, but it's like, gatekeeping in D&D? The book is like $26. You know, Jeremy Crawford's talking about how you can download it for free online.
Yep.
So go get the book and start your own group. What do you want to play with those assholes for anyway? That's the beauty of D&D. It's like, just go start your own group and invite some people over. If you can DM, you're always going to have friends. It's like being a DJ at the house party.
Yeah.
That's
great. You're always going to have a friend if you can run a game. You know, so I just encourage people, just get out there and do it. The rules are easy enough now. Like I said, I've ensured that nobody's going to beat you up over playing. And if they do want to beat you up, you send them my way.
Yeah, baby.
Or Big Show's way, or you know, any of my CrossFit champion trainer's way, who's in my group. You know, we'll take care of him for you.
I do not know how the world became what it is. I'm not
don't recognize this world that I'm living in anymore.
We all grew up, man. We all grew up. We grew, you know, I spent 30 years in a gym and in a boxing ring trying to become Conan the Barbarian. And a lot of people in the generation did that too, you know?
That's fantastic.
That's amazing.
You know, I mean, we were talking earlier about, you know, how you guys started gaming together, how Dan and I started gaming together. Dan and I started gaming 20 years ago when we briefly worked together at the same company. And the really fascinating thing about gaming is that it forms these bonds, right? I have plenty of coworkers that I worked with for a couple of years and never saw again. But the coworkers that I started playing D&D with, I mean, here we are 20 years later, still talking about it, still getting together to do it. Like, it really builds those bonds.
You just keep coming back to it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean, anybody... Joe just put a thread out a couple days ago with one of our old players, Dave Brown, who I haven't seen Dave in years, but Dave was one of those OG gamers, man, that Joe's campaign run. And I just, it's amazing how everybody that I've gamed with at some point in my life essentially is still in my life.
Yeah.
And it may go years. Yeah. I mean, you know, like I said, we played college and then after college, I took less of a break than Joe, but still years off, years on, but still coming back to it, coming back to it, coming back to it. And I just, now it's all about just influencing my next generation, my own children, my students. Now it's just go learn. I will teach you. I will help you. You are our future. Joe and many others have paved the way, and now it's here for you. And it's cool.
And before we got online, Steve, you were telling us about, like, you know, the students that you teach, you know, being digital natives and actually having some trouble with interpersonal social skills in person. And it's just, you know, the role playing is just the best hobby for personal interactions at a table in a room to make these kinds of real person connections. And if some of us are a little socially awkward, maybe, like, it's a great way to play test, literally, you know, try out how would this kind of interaction happen? How would this kind of interaction work with other people? And it's just the best hobby to, you know, get offline when you need to and spend time face to face, you know, together. It's so nice that we have that available to us.
Well, that's right, Dan. I mean, I think it's you know, the beauty of it is that immersion, the ability, this game, it's super addictive. My God.
Yeah, it is. It is.
just a little
you
bit.
Get immersed in, you know, where, like, you know, a lot of the friends that I had as kids growing up, like Steve was saying, like what's amazing to me about it is you don't say, hey, remember that time when we played that game and you rolled this dice and that happened and this, it was, no. Remember that time when we were in that dungeon and we came upon that, that undead creature and we killed it together. You know, it's like everyone says it in the first person. Like we were there. It's not like, remember when my character, it's like, we did this thing together and it lives in your brain. Like you have the memories I have of it are memories that I have of like the screen pictures that we created in our mind's eye. And I think, in today's world where we're all on the phone and the computer, people just want to put it down and interact with each other. It's like, I don't want to go put a headset on, sit in a dark room by myself and play a video game. I mean, even though, you know, that's very popular, I want to sit around a table and laugh and talk shit and have a good time and see the gang, you know, face to face. And I think that's really important. You know, I'm on the board at Pittsburgh Children's Hospital. And
great place.
I brought the game back to the kids. I started a club, and I brought them all these books. Watsy gave me a bunch of books, and I brought them and taught the kids how to play and run their own games so that these kids who, like, have double lung transplants and, you know, are sitting there for hours at a time getting IV drips and whose parents can't be there because they're working to pay the medical bills can get out of themselves and not be sick kids anymore. They can be a green dragonborn in a group with a dwarf fighter and they can just go somewhere else. And I think it's really important for people to do that.
Let me ask about, so for me, right, so I got a math degree and I work as a math professor now. And I say largely I was on that trajectory because of questions I had about like probability and statistics and game balance in D&D. And, you know, Paul is still in the video game industry. That's where we met, and he's made a whole career longer than I did in clearly starting with role-playing games. Do you feel like starting with role-playing games, like, fed into your careers? Like, Joe, you as an actor, Steve as an educator?
Well, I produce, I write, you know, and act. And I mean, when I was on True Blood, I was playing a man who transforms into a wolf with a bunch of vampires and fairies and fantasy creatures. And I was tasked with the job of developing a character over, you know, an episode or a season at a time, or two seasons or multiple seasons, which is just what I did when I was a kid. You know, creating a backstory for a character like Stanley Kowalski is the process is no different than creating the backstory of your character in D&D. So I was working those muscles out as a kid before I actually knew that was a job that you could make money. And, you know, like I said, Dan and Dave from Game of Thrones play in my group, and that's exactly what they do. You know, whether you're John Favreau, you know, with Mandalorian, it's writing is sitting in a room DMing. Yeah. It's writing your adventures. I mean, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And for me, I am a pretty intense person, and just the ability to DM over the last 15, 20 years leading up to me becoming a teacher, you can be the best teacher in the world. You can have everything down, but if your delivery is off, the chances of the kids getting what you're trying to disseminate is not going to be great. But if you bring that passion and you bring that intensity, and as a DM, you do a lot of talking, you become a better orator, it's helped me tremendously in the education field. I've got to bring the passion to these kids to want to learn the basics so that, hey, you know, the language, the math, all of this Common Core stuff, use it. And then take it and now play some D&D with me, you know, and get passionate about it and be open to talking about it and take some chances and don't be afraid. So, it's
Paul, definitely. Paul and I have a friend that a couple of years ago said, DMing and teaching are very similar. And I actually resisted that for a number of years. And then for some reason, there was some day where what you just said, Steve, clicked. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's basically all the same skill set. Totally. So if most of us nowadays are playing fifth edition, like I find usually there's at least a couple things from like an older edition that I want to still see in my game. Do you guys have any particular like house rules that you guys use with fifth edition specifically to tweak it to your taste?
I think things like the Yawning Portal, the 5e supplement that where they mod those dungeons for 5e. So it's like the classics. It's, White Plume Mountain and Tomb of Horrors and Hidden Temple of Tamochan, you know, like all of the... on the Citadel. So I think those provide good templates for, how to mod old, take old modules and update them or... I have all those old books. I incorporate all that stuff. You know, I think like Tyranny of Dragons, for example, it takes place in the Forgotten Realms. Why wouldn't that this module of the dragon cult attempting to bring Tiamat back, why wouldn't that stand on the shoulders of this civilization underneath that existed pre-5e with, you know, the cult of the dragon, where they were trying to bring all these undead dragons to life, and why wouldn't that be part of the history of the realm as well? So from a dramaturgy standpoint, I had actually a kind of a piece of adventure that I put in the middle because I just didn't want my players on the road for that long. If people didn't know that module, you're on the road for like 10 adventures, it's and then you go on the road for another like three more sessions. It's like I can't in good faith invite my players over for 13 weeks in a row where they're on a wagon train. Like, I got to break this up somehow. And, there's Dragon Spear Castle. Oh, cool. Well, I'm going to build that out and run an old school classic dungeon modded for 5e. you know, in the depths, in the pits of that, and you know, and it involved all that old lore. So, you know, I'm a big fan of incorporating, because I think at WotC, that's kind of what they were doing with 5e, was they were taking all these old modules, you know, like Tomb of Annihilation is a combination of Tomb of Horrors, you know, all those Chult modules,
right,
you know, even a little Isle of Dread kind of wrapped up into one.
Right.
And so I'm, you know, I'm a big proponent of all of that. You just have to mod the monsters, you know, when it says a Wraith, yeah, you got to pull the Wraith card. And unfortunately, it's not going to be wiping out levels of experience for your players like it did in 1E. But, you know.
I see that I still run games like that, right? That, and my players hate it, right? So when they, when a White or a Wraith show up, they know things are real freaking serious at that point. But I might possibly do that in fifth edition just to stick it to people.
Yeah, tell me how that goes. Yeah,
yeah. They'll hate it, but that's the game.
Yeah. You're gonna have a blog site dedicated to hate mail.
How about you, Steve? Is there any stuff from your older days that you're pulling forward into?
Yeah, there are. Less than Joe with incorporating the D&D, when I was still running Palladium, I had kind of switched over the Palladium rules and put them in a Star Wars universe just because I thought it was fun, having lightsabers would be cool. And early on, it was kind of set during the Clone Wars time. There were a lot of droids. A lot of droids, and droids, you know, just go easily. So I kind of created this 50 droid battle, which I really liked. It just gave you the ability. It's a lot of quick rolling 20s. If you hit over a certain number, like an 11 or so, you got the kill after every 5 kills or so. There was a percentile chance of taking damage from a stray blaster. Now, that doesn't fit in to the D&D world too much because I'm now pretty much a stickler for the rules. We go by what the rules are saying, but...
Great.
I'm running a Kryn adventure right now, Dragons of the Autumn Twilight, kind of starting homebrewed in that I've written it myself, but I'm sort of following the story, and I can't do that. I can't do the 50 battle because there's nowhere in the rules does it say anything like that. But they're in Zaxxaroth, and they're trying to find the discs of Mishakal, and they're in the crypts of the Utkiri. And I bring back Wolffang, this ghost, you know, who's kind of going to tell the story of the Plains people. And what I can do there, and I can't do it too often, but I can kind of have an NPC tell a story. And as that story's being told, the history of him and his peoples, my characters live vicariously through it. So War of the Ogres comes around, and then all of a sudden I can put a 50 ogre battle in there, which allows for some quick rolling. Joe's done my 50 dice battles. They're fun. Yeah. They're fun. They're not D&D technicalities, but I'm outside the realm of what I'm doing. And it's a dreamscape, so I can pull it off. But use that few and far between. Again, most of the stuff I do is just the storytelling, the ideas that I've had for years, built in. I've run campaigns in Forgotten Realms, all over, so
interesting.
Good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think, you know, the speed of combat, right, is definitely a thing that I sometimes struggle with in 5th edition that I miss from the older editions, which is, you know, I want my combats to be really, really fast and really snappy, and it's not because I don't like combat, it's I want more of them. Right, I want to jump from combat to combat to combat. So, like one thing I've tried, and I still use it if I can get away with it, is ask the players, and I always ask the players for permission on this because I know I'm kind of bending the rules of doing a group based initiative where they roll one as a group, roll a die, I roll a die, and then we just go around the table rather than individuals, just because it's a little faster.
Yeah.
But inevitably, that breaks down when somebody's got a 5th edition character whose build is really like, no, I'm really good at initiative, or I get advantage, or I get these bonuses when I win, and then I go, all right, well, then I guess we're going back down to an individual.
Yep.
Well, and I think what you're talking about is engagement,
yeah,
and trying to keep, you know, your players engaged. And, you know, my group is like oftentimes 9 or 10. I'm DMing for 9 or 10, which is like two groups in one.
Yeah, it's a big group.
And, you know, a couple of the things that I do, I mean, also, like, I think in LA, there's a lot of, like, really, really hardcore players. And it sounds like you guys have the same thing in your group. But they're, you know, there's a lot of min-maxers and people that are into the math probabilities and that have constructed these crazy characters. You know, I will say that luckily in my group, they do care about character story. It's not just about two levels of this and one of that and one of that and one of that. So I can get this and I can, you know, break the game somehow. But I make my players roll. We roll initiative. We roll initiative for every round.
Really?
Do you? So that it
does, and that's a house rule that I have. So it doesn't stay the same order. And also it puts hex into effect or other, when someone has disadvantage on ability checks, it actually incentivizes that. Because I find that when you're in a combat, you're like, okay, I hex and I don't know, strength, you know, but nobody grapples. So you never see that used. But if you can hex somebody's dexterity at, you know, or and at disadvantage, then they have disadvantage on initiative. So you're actually trying to gain. And also when people get into death saves, all of a sudden you want to roll low.
Right.
You know, or a dragon could be at the end of the round. And then all of a sudden, ba-boom, first up, and now you're in big trouble. So it adds a kind of a freshness, because what happens is I'm trying to keep my players from zoning out and calculating how many minutes it's going to be between my turns. Yeah. So I'm going to go secretly look at Instagram under the table until it gets close to me, and I'm going to have no idea what's going on. Like that, I try to...
Joe and I both play with big groups. I mean, Joe, how many... your Friday nights, there's 8, 9, 10 guys, right?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. I'm looking at about 8, 9 people almost always as well. That's where it gets tricky. I mean, ultimately.
Have you guys ever in your life, so with Palladium, I don't know how it worked. Like, have you guys ever, so the earliest editions of D&D, you know, worked on these party-based initiative where it's just like one player, you know, the leader of the party rolls, the DM rolls, and then you go around the table. Have you guys ever played like that in your life?
I have not.
No, I haven't played group by group. No, I've only done individual. But like I said, it's like trying to figure out ways to keep them.
Yeah. You might try it once, because I find that, like, because it's just it's one less thing to worry about. It goes a little faster, and people can physically see around the table as the, you know, as the actor is coming around to them. So I find that it tends to keep my players a little bit more on the page about physically seeing when their action's about to come up. But I know it's not 5th edition, but you might try it sometime.
I know Dan and I both experienced the same kind of funny phenomenon based on doing that, which is at some point the players say, well, can we get up and change seats? And I'm like, whatever, do what you got to do. And so I've actually seen that happen in a game where players get up, grab their stuff, and run around the table so that they can change the initiative order.
That's interesting.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'll have to try that.
Yeah, I'm going to have to try that too, I think. That sounds, pretty cool.
Yeah.
And Paul and I were in a game 2 years ago at Gary Con with Bill Webb, and there were 26 people at the table. And I don't know how he would have managed it if he weren't just going around the table like that.
26 people.
But it still wound up fun, you know, and people still wound up talking. It was interesting. It was like the whole village grabbed torches and went to go fight this thing. And
exactly.
Yeah, I've been in those games, but you're also like, man, if half the party dies, like, it's still going to be really interesting. You know, like, it takes on this kind of different energy where, like, anybody can go at any minute.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're running a little long here, so I just want to ask, does anybody have any final thoughts on bringing old school ideas into 5th edition? Anything that we missed that you want to make sure we get in here?
I just go with what Joe was saying. Don't have any fear. No. Just have fun. If you want to. I mean, you can go so many different avenues. You want to really get skills technical? Then do it. Read. You're going to need to read a lot. You want to meld a little bit of something maybe you've played before? Do that too. I mean, everybody and their mother's streaming these days. Yeah. So the field's oversaturated to a degree. Just do it and have fun and get passionate about it. That's my number one thing, would be passionate above all else.
I think, you know, in like an era of tolerance, I find that the modern gaming community is very tolerant of everything except for those old school Conan the Barbarian-esque ideas. You know, it's like D&D can be all things for everybody. Unless you swear, unless you torture people. If anyone hits on a barmaid, I'm stopping my game right there. It's like, oh my God. You know, I DM for a bunch of married guys. It's like, as soon as they come back into town from off the road, they immediately go to the tavern, and it's like barmaid charisma rolls.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's like, but who am I to like time out? You can't be that. It's like, give me a break. Yeah. Like,
Yeah, and I'm all for torturing.
Let me do what they want, you know? And as a DM, it's fun. I mean, part of the fun of it is like, I get to watch this show. I mean, I'm participating, I'm kind of show running the show, but I'm also like, I love it when they try to put their plans together. I love when they try to figure out what they're going to do next. I love seeing them, you know, like I said, like, you know, the Goliath is going to hit on this barmaid, and then I'm going to be now playing the barmaid, doing her voice with the guys. You know, it's, so I would say that, like, you know, I find that, you know, there's this, you know, like I said, this tolerance, but there's like kind of this ignoring the fact that it's this fun game. It's supposed to be fun, and it's a fun game about, like, people getting outside of themselves, but also it's about, like, cutting people's heads off and lighting people on fire.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with
and
that.
And sending assassins after your own character teammates. I mean, like, it's a
free-for-all. Well, it can be that year game. But, yeah, my guy relates to it. But, you know, it's, you know, I just think, you know, it's a lot of things to a lot of different people, but, you know, the old school way was like, you know, we came out of Grimdark and we came out of Wargaming and we came out of Conan the Barbarian. And so I think there's a danger to the way that we used to play. I like seeing that incorporated. And I think that, you know, playing in a live stream event where someone, rather than attacking the demon that had a headless bleeding corpse in its hand, they went out and tried to pet it and talk to it. It's like, let's not get too far away from what this game is, which is, you know, it came from Wargaming, and that's a big part of it that I think people try to ignore.
I'm glad to hear that. Actually, I was thinking about that this week, as a matter of fact. There are parts of that risk, of that danger that I kind of don't really want to lose.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Should we? Great, Paul. Do you have any other thoughts?
No. I think we're good. Let's. I want to give a quick moment here for to take a quick moment to highlight one of our patron benefactors. If everyone's okay with that. Patron Ash Adler recently became a benefactor. He writes a blog at ashadler.com and would like you to know that he has two novels available now that you can check out, titled Deceit and Seraphel, which you can see here. You can find those on his blog in the About Ash Adler section or via quick search on Amazon or Smashwords. Ash would like us to note that his books do contain elements of dark fantasy and adult themes, discretion is advised. If you're interested in us highlighting your work here on Wandering DMs, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms and consider becoming a benefactor.
And that's right. And thanks to Joe and Steve for appearing here with us today. So Steve wanted everybody to know about his East Coast Slayers group, to look for that, and also to look at Critit. .co.uk that's on the screen right now, which has dice and adventures and supplements for D&D and role-playing. Is that right, Steve?
Yeah, Dominic Marriott has been a great supporter of the East Coast Slayers. Always sending cool things. You guys are each going to be getting a set of the Spirit of the Arctic dice coming soon. He has sent me my DM shield, which is just sick, plus tons and tons of other things. The East Coast Slayers is a Facebook closed group. We've got some streams on there. Joe appeared on one a while back. We haven't been doing that. I need to get my tech up and running a little better. But yeah, Critit UK. Also, big shout out to my students in Room 12 at Wolf Pit School. Love you all. And to my very own children, Owen and Eloise. Daddy loves you both.
Awesome.
Awesome. And on Joe's end, so he has the Death Saves site, which is on his T-shirt right now.
Yeah. In fact, three out of four of us on the screen wearing our Death Saves shirt.
Ooh, nice.
I did not get the memo. I apologize. So that's at death-saves.com online. Has apparel and also dice and gaming related stuff like that, and great artwork. Look for Joe, who also worked on contributed to the Baldur's Gate Avernus product from WotC. That's out right now. And also Gale Force 9. Is that right, Joe? Did I get that right?
Yeah, Gale Force 9. So I wrote part of that Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus book, and my characters, Archon the Cruel, Krull, Torgar, Steelfist, who are Archon's minions, they appear in this storyline. And Gale Force 9 just released the first miniatures set of Archon, Krull, and Torgar together, which you can get from them.
Great.
Awesome. Great. Thanks so much, everyone, for joining us. If you have any thoughts on incorporating old school ideas into 5th edition D&D, we'd love to hear from you. Please drop us some comments here in this video and tell us what you think.
I'm going to say one last thing. So, Joe, thank you for being a D&D ambassador. I went out many, many, many years. I'm a little bit older than you guys, and I would not have believed that D&D would become publicly acceptable and popular and okay with our students on network television like you've done. So I personally really appreciate the labor you've put into that.
Thanks, man. It's been a pleasure. If you would have told the kid that I was that I'd be able to do the things that I'm doing now with the company, I mean, that was the job that I wanted. I wanted to be Gary Gygax. I wanted to run TSR, and, you know, I get to do a modicum of that.
Awesome. Amazing.
Amazing.
Totally amazing. So to all of our viewers, remember you can like, follow, and subscribe to us on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch by the handle WanderingDMs.
Also, our shows are available in audio-only podcast format. You can find those on our website, WanderingDMs.com, as well as all the major podcast carriers, Google, iTunes, Spotify, whatever. If you are listening to this show on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us. We really appreciate it.
Big thanks to all of our patrons who support the show, and if you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Remember, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so please join us next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.